Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Don't look now, but Alan Greenspan says we're out of the subprime woods. The former Fed chairman spoke at a conference in Spain today. His exact words were, "The worst is over." You can believe him or not, it's up to you, but I don't think we need to tell you which way congressional Democrats are leaning. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Consumer Consequences, American Public Media's online game, exploring what the world would be like if everyone on Earth consumed like you. Online at consumerconsequences.org. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years, with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday today, the 3rd of October. So glad to have you with us. We've got one for drugs, we've got one for the war, and now the majority party in Congress wants one for the mortgage industry. Democrats lined up behind the microphones on Capitol Hill today and called on the president to appoint a mortgage czar. It's not so much about the credit crunch, they said, as it's about the homeowners likely to face foreclosure in the coming months, and about having somebody at the federal level to coordinate the government's response to that. House Financial Services Committee Chairman Barney Frank agreed something should have been done long ago.
First, it is a legitimate question people have asked. Why did Congress not act? And I want to give the straightforward, honest, nonpartisan answer. Because the Republicans were in control, and they didn't want to do that.
Of course, there's plenty of blame to go around in who should have done what when as the subprime mess bubbled to the economic surface. But a special dose of scorn has been reserved for mortgage companies, one of them in particular, a company that media investigations say treated its customers like cash cows, whose CEO pulled down hundreds of millions of dollars, which has laid off 12,000 people and which has seen its stock price tank. So America's biggest mortgage company has called in the PR guys. The Wall Street Journal reported this morning Countrywide's gearing up for a major public relations campaign. It won't be the first time a big company's asked for help when it's hit big trouble. But Marketplace's Steve Tripoli reports Countrywide needs to take care how it deploys the PR playbook.
Damage containment is a hot and growing niche in public relations, says longtime New Jersey PR man Alan Karuba.
There are any number of firms that specialize in what is called reputation management and crisis control.
If a PR firm's resume is any indication of a company's woes, it looks like Countrywide fears it has trouble. It's hiring Burson Marsteller, a veteran of Johnson & Johnson's poison Tylenol debacle. The firm also handled the U.S. Postal Service's anthrax crisis and recent corporate embarrassments over Chinese toys. Boston PR executive Larry Karpman says the standard playbook for companies in crisis has three elements.
They need to explain what happened. Two, they need to try to make people whole. And the third thing is to create a plan to show customers and regulators that this won't happen again.
But today's journal says Countrywide's taking a very different tack, digging in its heels. The company's reportedly going to claim that it's scrupulously ethical and simply on a mission to help more Americans own their homes. Alan Karuba says in that case they'd better be able to show that the allegations of sleazy tactics are hogwash.
There's an old expression that just because you put lipstick on a pig, it doesn't change the pig. And there is really no amount of public relations that can reverse the facts.
But PR exec Larry Karpman says even if the facts make Countrywide look bad, all's not lost. I asked if a firm can overcome very negative publicity when it's true.
Can you spell Tylenol? Not the same thing, but the answer is yes.
But Karpman still insists that coming clean about anything that did go wrong comes first. I'm Steve Tripoli for Marketplace.
Countrywide's become the subprime buzzword here. Over in the UK, it's a lender called Northern Rock. A couple of weeks ago, customers staged a good old-fashioned run on the bank after Northern Rock accepted a government bailout. But its fortunes seem to have turned. There are reports today of private equity groups putting together a $30 billion buyout bid for the bank. One day after a hearing into reports of trigger-happy private military contractors in Iraq, the House of Representatives has moved to hold those contractors accountable. The growing role of private security forces in war zones has exposed a legal gray area that shields them, or some of them anyway, from U.S. or Iraqi laws. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports.
The legislation would bring federal contractors working alongside U.S. troops under the criminal jurisdiction of U.S. courts. Sponsors say a loophole in the law has allowed alleged criminal behavior by security guards working for private contractor Blackwater USA to go unpunished. The bill calls for special FBI investigative units in war zones and requires disclosure from the Justice Department of charges and legal actions against contractors.
Anything that enhances the accountability is good for our industry.
Doug Brooks is president of the International Peace Operations Association, which represents private security companies. He says a clarification of legal liability is something they've been asking for decades.
There's been a lot of accusations. There hasn't been a whole lot of follow-up from the government side, and that's sort of frustrating from our industry perspective because we get hammered on this issue a lot.
More regulations on private contractors may take away some of their war zone advantages, such as their quick adaptability and cost-effectiveness. But David Eisenberg at the British American Security Information Council says it's worth it.
The private contractors are being employed in pursuit of a public goal. In effect, they are carrying out U.S. military and U.S. foreign policy. Their actions reflect directly upon the United States and its standing in the world. The price you may pay in terms of inefficiency is actually, I think, a public good.
Senate legislation to impose U.S. criminal jurisdiction over private contractors is being drafted by Illinois Democrat Barack Obama. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you want to buy something online, it's pretty basic. You point, you click, you're done. Not so, though, for some Target shoppers, which has led to a new class action lawsuit against the retailer. It claims Target is breaking state and federal laws because its website isn't accessible to the blind. Sarah Gardner reports.
Most of us use the internet so frequently we don't even think about it. But the 1.3 million blind people in the U.S. certainly do. They have to buy and install screen reading software that can translate website text into audio.
Are you worried that you are taking the wrong medicine? Your worries are over.
That's the sound of an ad on a commercial website that sells visual aids for the sight impaired. The retailer specially encoded the text so the blind can hear about the merchandise it sells and then, without using a mouse, make a purchase. But plaintiffs in this lawsuit say Target.com has failed to do that. And that, they say, is discrimination. John Perret is with the National Federation of the Blind.
As an example, the Walmart site we have tested quite thoroughly, and it is accessible. And if Walmart can do it, the question is, why can't Target do it?
Perret admits that since the lawsuit was filed last year, Target has tried to make its website more accessible, but he contends it still has problems. Target didn't return calls by deadline, but it released a statement insisting its website is fully accessible. The company has argued in court that the Americans with Disabilities Act applies to its brick-and-mortar stores only, not the internet. Southwest Airlines won a similar lawsuit in 2002 using that argument. But advocates for the blind hope this class action suit will eventually force all e-tailers to open their doors to the blind. If not that, it could certainly open their eyes to a whole new group of potential customers. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Investors gave it up today to the tune of about 0.5% across the board. Their hearts weren't really in it, though. Wall Street's pretty much got its eye on the key September unemployment report. That's due out Friday morning. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Just in time for the holiday shopping season, technophiles looking for the latest in smartphones or music players have an abundance of choices. Microsoft released the latest version of its Zune MP3 player yesterday. Today, Verizon unveiled some new handsets, including something iPhone-like called the Voyager. Their target, of course, is pretty much anything made by Apple, either the iPhone or its newest iPod called the Touch. Kevin Pereira from G4 Television is here to talk gadgets. Hey, Kevin, how are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
What's the toy of the day?
The toy of the day is one that you can't get your hands on if you go to the store, and everybody's clamoring for it. It's the new iPod Touch.
All right. Let's refresh people's memory. What exactly is the iPod Touch?
Well, the iPod Touch is sort of like the iPhone without the ability to actually call people. So if you have the latest firmware for your iPhone, it's actually just like the iPhone. Here it is, iPod Touch.
Yeah.
It's
thinner, though, right? I mean, I'm no iPod connoisseur, but...
Here's the iPhone to compare.
Yeah.
Definitely thinner, definitely lighter. The back is a nice kind of brushed metal instead of this matte finish, which means all your fingerprints and makeup smudges, if you're in TV like me, they're going to show up. Whether you want it to or not.
Oh, you TV guys with the makeup.
Yeah.
Who's going to buy this thing?
People who didn't want to sign up for AT&T and people who want a new iPod with the cool touchscreen interface.
Right.
Now, if you've got 160 gigs worth of music, obviously that's not going to fit. The device comes in 8 and 16 gig flavors, which is, you know, a couple hours of music, not a couple years worth of music. So if you want a smaller library, a nice thin device, if you like watching video casts on the bus or in the bathroom, hey, there you go.
How much is this going to set me back?
$400.
I'm sorry, say that again?
That would be $400
for the 16 gig
version. Yes. But it's also an internet-enabled device. So, you know, not only do you have your music and your video casts, but if you're in a cafe or at a Starbucks, you can pull it out, surf the net, send email, watch YouTube videos. You can do all that right from the one device.
One would hope that Steve Jobs has learned his lesson, but what's to promise me that in 2 months, I'm not going to be able to get this for $200 cheaper?
I can promise you that in probably 4 months, you will be able to get it for $100 to $200 cheaper.
All right, so I'm not buying this today. I'm not, as cool as this thing is, I'm not going to go out and buy it now.
Well, that's a good thing because they're sold out everywhere. I mean, you could go and order it online, and you're still not going to get it for a couple months.
Did all the cool stuff from the phone make it over minus the phone part?
No, that's the sad thing. It's the same software as the iPhone running on the iPod Touch, and yet they took out some really critical applications, email being one of them.
Yeah.
Now, if you can use the Safari web browser, connect to Gmail, and send email that way, but there's no built-in email application. And a lot of people are upset because this hasn't been hacked yet, like the iPhone, so you can't get cool games or GPS or any other neat applications on it yet. That will come in time, but for right now, it is just a device for people who want to keep their current cell phone, have a new iPod, and be able to browse the net from time to time.
Let's talk about Apple, the company and the business, before I let you go here. Obviously, the iPod is a paradigm-changing thing. I mean,
it
absolutely changed the terms of the debate on cell phones and music players and all that good stuff. Is the iPod Touch going to do that?
No. And a short answer, no. I mean, the iPod Touch is really competing with the other brands of iPods and with the iPhone itself. You know, there are competitors making Wi-Fi enabled video players out there, so it's not a paradigm shift. But Apple as a company is now in a very precarious position where they used to be the company for the consumer, and now that they've entered their markets with protected media and companies wanting to secure data and lock you into contracts, people are starting to look and frown upon Apple for making them pay a buck for a song and then another buck for a ringtone.
So really, it's only going to get harder for them.
Definitely. They have a very uphill battle from here on out. The good news is, for Apple, they've got the best hardware. I mean, they have the sexiest, most attractive phone that people want. The bad news is they're alienating customers left and right by locking them out of their phones and making them upgrade iTunes to lose certain functionality. So they have a balancing act ahead of them, and it's going to be interesting to see how it shakes out.
Kevin Pereira from G4, Attack of the Show. Kevin, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
What? When that September unemployment report I was talking about does come out on Friday morning, a good many analysts are going to dig down in search of one particular number: how many jobs were added or lost in the construction business. That figure is going to speak volumes about how badly the housing slump and the credit squeeze are beating up the rest of the economy. In a way, though, construction, building infrastructure itself, is beating up the economy all by itself. From WBUR in Boston, Monica Brady Myrov explains.
Orange construction barrels line parts of Massachusetts Avenue in Cambridge. Work to repave the road connecting MIT and Harvard, redo the sidewalks, and add trees started 3 years ago this fall. That's when MIT engineering professor Fred Movenzeta greeted a new class of freshmen. Now those students are seniors, but the road project is only three-quarters complete.
This paving of this street could have been done in less than 6 months rather than taking 3 years. If they had put sufficient manpower and equipment, day in, day out, night in, night out.
Thousands of roads and bridges across the country are in this predicament. In Massachusetts alone, 43% of the road and highway projects under construction aren't finished on time. Taxpayers foot the overruns to the tune of $30 million a year, and that's just Massachusetts. Nationally, the problem explodes into a $1.6 trillion headache. Barry LePatner is a construction lawyer who follows the industry closely.
If we were to start allocating immediately even $100 billion, $100 billion, to attend to the most needed repairs on the highways, bridges, and tunnels around our nation that are in imminent danger, then we may be in jeopardy through our construction industry of wasting as much as $50 billion of that through inefficiency.
The first problem is the industry's bidding process. The lowest bidder often wins. But Professor Movenzeta says that low bidder knows his offer is unrealistic.
These contractors really reduce the cost to bare bone in order to get the job. So obviously you expect some delays or cost overruns or complication in the future.
Then there's a rush to get things built, even though the state hasn't finished approving the designs. Again, Barry LePatner.
No one should start a construction project in this nation unless the drawings and specifications prepared by the architects and the engineers are 100% complete and prepared in conjunction with review by the contractors.
When the contractor hasn't approved the plans, it's easy to run into unforeseen problems, like the need to move a telephone pole. And then the state has to pay for the fix. LePatner says you wouldn't remodel your kitchen this way, so why rebuild a road or bridge like this? But Massachusetts Highway Commissioner Louisa Pywonski says the state bureaucracy isn't efficient either.
I think it's fair to say that while there are often good reasons for construction delays, including environmental or work permit restrictions or utility delays, that doesn't mean that we find that acceptable.
Another problem is that the industry is composed of lots of small companies that don't have the money to invest in research or the latest technology. LePatner says no wonder we're building our roads and bridges very much the same way we were 150 years ago. In Boston, I'm Monica Brady Myrov for Marketplace.
Coming up, stomachs rumble as prices rise in Argentina.
I love mozzarella. I can buy it. 3 months ago, yes. But now, I can buy it.
But first, let's do the numbers. Markets continued on their downward pace today ahead of a jobs report due out Friday that could be less than rosy. The Dow Industrial shaved off 79 points, about a half a percent, finished at 13,968. The NASDAQ gave up 17.6 tenths of 1% to end at 2729. The S&P 500 nicked off 7 points, nearly half a percent, to close at 1539. Morgan Stanley told investors to unload shares in Intel and Advanced Micro Devices. Apparently a chip glut and a price war could be in the offing. Intel took a more than 2% hit, but AMD ticked up 0.25%. Micron Technology plunged nearly 9% after reporting a larger quarterly loss than expected. Same story. Price drops in chips that store data in cameras and music players. Home construction stocks kept going in the other direction. Beazer Homes hammered 8.5%. 4.5% higher. Lennar nailed a 4.5% gain. Pulte Homes and D.R. Horton both picked up around 3%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. By Siemens. From grade school to grad school, Siemens supports America's next generation of innovators with Student Science Days, plus scholarships and awards for students, schools, and teachers. And by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals and institutions reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. These days, it seems that everyone is talking about sustainability. Want to know how you fit in? A new online game from American Public Media can help you find out what the world might look like if everyone lived, or at least consumed, like you. Go to our website, marketplace.org, and click on Consumer Consequences.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on factory orders for August. The Joint Economic Committee of Congress holds a hearing to examine the skyrocketing costs associated with mass incarceration. They say the U.S. has 25% of the world's prisoners, despite having only 5% of the world's population. And a House committee discusses the right of communities to know about toxic waste sites nearby. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. President Bush uncapped his veto pen today for only the fourth time since he took office, and on a bill that has broad support in Congress, too. Unless House Democrats can swing some Republicans to vote their way, though, the state children's health insurance program, or SCHIP, won't be getting any bigger this year. Healthcare is the biggest domestic issue in the 2008 presidential race. Everybody's feeling the pinch, even enormous companies. General Motors, for one example, just unloaded billions of dollars in health care obligations. Commentator Robert Reich thinks GM's a fine example for the rest of the country.
GM isn't the only big company to stop insuring the health of its employees. According to a recent survey by the Kaiser Family Foundation, the portion of firms offering health benefits has dropped from 69 to 60% in just 7 years. Even among workers who still get them, benefits are getting stingier. Last year, 38% of workers had to pay deductibles of $500 or more. Meanwhile, copayments and premiums are soaring. In other words, the whole system of employer-based health care is unraveling. Why? Because in an ever more competitive global economy, companies can't afford its rising costs, and their shareholders don't want to face its increasing risks and uncertainties. Even for workers, the employer-based system makes less and less sense. These days, most people move from job to job, which means they lose coverage between jobs when they and their families are especially strapped. And a growing number aren't even tied to a particular employer at all. I say let's just scrap the employer-based system altogether. Use the $200 billion or so of annual tax deductions the system now relies on for employers and employees to help lower-income Americans who aren't poor enough to qualify for Medicaid afford basic health insurance. And then allow anybody who wants to reduce their health insurance costs to join them, along with retirees, government workers, and the poor, all of whom are already in government plans, in a super Medicare plan that would have so many members it could negotiate with drug companies, suppliers, and hospitals for bargain basement rates. It's a win-win-win. Employers no longer pay rising health care costs. Employees get affordable health insurance even when they're between jobs or have no steady employer. Nobody loses any options they now have. The only losers are the big insurance companies, hospital chains, and drug companies. It seems like a small price to pay, doesn't it?
The latest book from former Labor Secretary Robert Reich is called Super Capitalism. He offered one idea about how to change the U.S. healthcare system, but there are others. If you have one of them, head over to our website to share it. Our homepage is marketplace.org. Click on the idea generator. As touchy as the U.S. Federal Reserve is about inflation, which is to say extremely touchy, rising prices are an even bigger issue down in Argentina. The country is still trying to put its economy back together after a near-complete collapse back in 2001. Tomorrow, the government will release its latest inflation figures. They're likely to show the annual rate somewhere around a moderate, for them, 8%. But that's a number many economists say is literally too good to be true. Rachel Hopkin reports now from Buenos Aires.
Mario is a carpenter. He lives in Buenos Aires. Every day he goes to the grocery store and he's been noticing some steep price rises.
I love mozzarella. I can buy it. 3 months ago, yes. But now, I can buy it.
Like a lot of Argentinians, Mario is getting worried. His country has made international headlines over the past few years thanks to the impressive recovery of its economy following the meltdown of 2001. But inflation, an old bugbear here in Argentina, is also back in impressive form. Federico Thompson is an economic analyst based in Buenos Aires.
But in 2003, inflation was around 3%. In 2004, it was around 6%. In 2005, around 12%. So it seemed to be doubling every year.
That's not necessarily cause for concern, says Argentine economist Alan Sibbles.
The truth is, any economy that grows at the rate Argentina's been growing, around 9% a year, is bound to experience some level of inflation. It is not something that one should be alarmed about.
But in Argentina, with its history of hyperinflation, inflation can easily cause alarm, not least within the government, which has used a heavy hand to try and control it. Federico Thompson explains.
It started by having price controls, price agreements, we call them in Argentina. Pretty soon, it turned out to be insufficient, as always happens. And therefore, they decided to go this extremely crude way of just manipulating the indicator.
That indicator is the official inflation rate for the Buenos Aires area, published each month by INDEC, the National Statistics Institute.
So you can't control the fever, you start to play around with the thermometer.
Alan Sibbles explains how the government is doing this.
For example, in January of this year, the government had agreed to an increase in health care costs of no more than 2%. Actual increases were 20%. So the number they used for the price index was the agreed price of 2% and not the actual increase.
Since January, several members of INDEC staff, unhappy with the deception, have resigned or been very publicly dismissed or demoted. Some rebel INDEC workers recently argued in Congress that the true annual rate of inflation is actually around 18%. That's more than twice the official figure of just over 8%.
Nobody actually believes that, on the right or the left, foreign or domestic, nobody believes what they're putting out. And every month, it's sort of the laughing stock of the economics establishment because of it.
Alan Sibbles. This crisis of credibility could be far more damaging for Argentina and its standing internationally than the inflation that triggered it. Federico Thompson advises foreign companies with an interest in Argentina.
Argentina was a country that defaulted on its public debt, devalued the currency when it had been promising it wouldn't, and in fact violated many contracts. So Argentina has an urgent need to overcome that by behaving with some credibility going forward.
Argentina will elect a new president on the 28th of October. Cristina Kirchner, wife of current president Néstor Kirchner, is widely expected to win. Assuming she does, inflation will be one of her first challenges. In the meantime, it's the Argentine middle classes who are feeling the pinch. In Buenos Aires, this is Rachel Hopkin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a mix of large U.S. companies can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, improving financial controls in public schools is important, I think we can all agree. So important that the city of Philadelphia recently paid consultants $700,000 to help officials there get a handle on their accounts. Sadly, their report was never read. When the Philadelphia Inquirer asked to see it not too long ago, school officials took a week to find the report. It did finally turn up today, 1 year after the consulting firm finished the job. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 79 points, about a half a percent. The Nasdaq off 17.6 tenths percent there. The S&P 500 dropped 7 points, nearly half a percent there. Our engineers include Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Nicole Imbornone, Eric Johnson, and Aaron Scott. Coming up next time, stacking timber interests against pleas to stay green.
We can't just, you know, look at a 400-year-old Douglas fir, you know, a tree that's older than the Constitution, and say that tree's primary value is 2x4s and toilet paper.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.